Well, all right then. Friday, 5 p.m. has finally rolled around. Time for American Hit Radio on 90.3 WHPC, WHPC HD. I'm Tom Ryan, your host for the next hour, if you're kind enough to stay with me. Of course, my lovely wife and co-host, Heidi Morales, Ryan here as well, running the board and keeping track of time and space. That's what she does. Now, of course, on Fridays, we call the show How Music Changed because we pick a whole bunch of different topics. Now, we've got 250 that we hope to cover in our lifetime, or maybe this lifetime and the next one, depending how much time it's going to take. But we started doing a series on Jimi Hendrix about 2 months ago, and we're up to part eight, which is an interesting part of his career. We just finished Jimmy's return to America and his playing in Monterey on the West Coast. That was part seven. And that's exactly where we're going to pick up here. Because, Jimmy's, I guess you could now say, glorious appearance at the Monterey Pop Festival garnered a lot of attention. But his time in America did not last very long, as he also had to return to England to finish preparing his second album. This show covers an era for an awesome new single and another riveting performance that he did on Radio 1 when he went back to England. So that's what we're going to cover. First up, though, is what Jimmy was doing. He already released three hit singles in Europe. He had yet to have a hit in the United States. None of his songs got anywhere near the top 40. The critics were saying that, you know, before he played Monterey, they were saying it's just too, you know, angry or too busy for the pop market. But Hendrix was getting so much attention after Monterey that maybe at this point in time it was time for a change. But he was getting depressed because, well, we played the song about two shows ago when he was in England and he was playing skeletal versions of the song that he wanted to be his next single. And it was very interesting. It was beautiful. But it was not coming together the way that he wanted it to. And he felt like it was taking much too long, where he would just put down version after version. So after the Monterey performance, he flew by plane, of course, from Los Angeles to New York City on July 3rd. And on that plane, he started writing out the song for the structure, the way that he would want it to be when he got to New York. And when he did get to New York, he went to Mayfair Studio on July 6th, 1967. And he recorded, if you can imagine this, 30 takes of the song. He was becoming obsessive, trying to get it as good as he possibly could. He brought in a group called the Sweet Inspirations to sing background. And I have nothing but praise for Jimmy by being that obsessed with what he was doing, because the result, in my opinion, might be the very best recording that he ever made. Now, there's an awful lot of great, great songs that Jimi Hendrix put out, but one of my personal favorites happens to be Burning of the Midnight Lamp. What's funny is it wasn't released as a single in America, and we had to wait for Hendrix's third album when it appeared on that, the double album, that came out in 1968. And the song was so hip that it was still one of the best songs on that album, even though it was already a year old, which is actually a long time in rock and roll years, so to speak. I mean, a lot changed between 1967 and 1968, but Jimmy's song, which was a hit in England, held on fast. I love this song. It's called Burning of the Midnight Lamp.
The morning
I just think that song is magical. It's just so incredible. And the lyrics are pretty much about the frustration that he was having with the song. It's a, you know, basically about a house in the desert and about basically he had no place to live because he was essentially a music gypsy. He didn't have a home. And he'd come into a city, he'd set up, he'd play, and then he'd pack up and leave as though he was never there. So the whole image of burning of the midnight lamp was probably something that was very emotional to him because he knew that he was basically a man without a home. Now, the B-side, every A-side is a B-side, right? And if you're doing the recording, well, not necessarily the recording because that was recorded in New York, but if you're going to release it in England, it's almost definitely means that the song is not going to end up on an album because that's pretty much the way that they operated in England for quite a while. Like the Beatles' hit singles were almost never on the actual albums. Hendrix was moving under the same basic principle. So the B-side was a song that was at first recorded in Los Angeles in late June of 67, somewhere around June 28th or maybe 30th. And then, just like Burning of the Midnight Lamp, when he flew to New York, he stayed at the studio and completed the song somewhere around July 19th or 29th on different dates. There's a lot of freaks in the studio on this song. It's rumored that maybe one of them is Frank Zappa. Now, the song is called The Stars That Play with Laughing Sam's Dice. Now, the Beatles had put out Sgt. Pepper, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, and everybody more or less knew that John was writing about LSD, although he denied it vociferously, saying that it was just from a painting that Julian did in school. But I never believed that for even half a second. And in this instance, maybe that's why John was maybe not wanting to say that he did that, because he was aware of the fact that he might not have been the only one who was playing with those letters or that alliteration. Because the stars that play with Laughing Sam's Dice, if you spell it out, is STP and LSD, two of the main psychedelic sources for drug use at that time. Jimmy couldn't deny it. At that point, you know, it was nothing to deny. It was pretty obvious, and the song itself more or less suggests that direction a little bit, quite obviously. So here is STP, LSD, or The Stars That Play with Laughing Sam's Dice. Stars on the ground that play with Laughing Sam's Dice. It's good. it's definitely one of the most incredible freak show releases that Hendrix had ever recorded, I think. The Stars That Play with Laughing Sam's Dice. Wouldn't be a B-side, but if you in the British version of the album Smash Hits, it was on that album, because I guess in England, that's what they would eventually do, is they would compile all the singles onto a greatest hits album. In America, they had a different idea of what smash hits would be. Of course, that would be the songs that got the most radio play. So that song was not included in the American version. But in the weeks following the band's magnificent, if I may say, Monterey appearance, which we covered last week, co-manager Michael Jeffrey booked the experience to open for the Monkees on their U.S. tour. Now, we didn't talk about Michael Jeffrey. We've only been talking about Chaz Chandler because he was the guy that was managing Hendrix and handling most of the stuff that was going on in Jimmy's life. And I think it, up to this point in time, Chandler was doing such an amazing job of getting everything. I mean, things were working for Jimmy so handily and coming through magnificently in just about every way under Chandler's control. But they brought in a co-manager, Michael Jeffrey, and he figures that it's a good idea to put Hendrix on tour with the Monkees. As he said, attempting to mirror the strategy that Chandler had employed when the Experience toured with the British teen idols like the Walker Brothers and such. However, Chandler was aghast, furious at Jeffrey's miscalculation of the United States music landscape. The Experience, Chandler argued, should be showcased in theaters, such as the Fillmore West in San Francisco, where the city was still abuzz after the group's impressive week-long stand there. The Experience pulled out from the tour after only a handful of dates, remedying Jeffrey's gaffe with a fabricated claim that the Daughters of the American Revolution considered the group's acts obscene. Determined to succeed in his own home country, Hendrix was relieved that the group had been freed from their commitment. The Monkees were like the Plastic Beatles, Hendrix remarked. Don't get me wrong. I liked the Monkees themselves. The personal part was beautiful. I got on with Mickey and Peter and we fooled around a lot together. We pulled out of the tour because there was a hassle. Firstly, we were not getting any billing. All the posters for the show just screamed out, Monkees! They didn't even know that we were there until we hit the stage. Then they gave us the death spot on the show, right before the Monkees were due on. The audience just screamed and yelled for the Monkees. It was just the wrong audience. I would say that's obviously true. Soon after that is when Hendrix returned to the UK to start working on his second album, which we will be covering hopefully in its entirety next week. But he had to get to business. He was still doing a lot of radio appearances. We've played a couple of tracks already from him appearing on the Saturday Club, the Radio 1 show, Saturday Club. We played two of those shows. There was another show called Top Gear, and he appeared on that in the fall of 1967. And I gotta say, I think that his appearance for the first Top Gear show that took place in the fall has some of the best live Jimi Hendrix performances I've ever heard. When I heard this next track, in fact, my brain exploded. I think it was like I couldn't get over that. I said, this is like one of the best things that Hendrix ever did in his life. So we'll play three tracks. Why not? We'll play everything that came out on that session. Going to start with the song that slayed me. It's called Driving South. That will segue into Catfish Blues. We heard a version of that, an earlier version of that in an earlier show. And then we'll also include his rather fun cover of the Elvis Presley tune. Well, this is the tune that Elvis Presley made famous anyway, called Hound Dog. Play them all in a row for you. Thank you.
Well, I wish I was a catfish swimming in love, the deep blue sea. I have all you pretty women fishing after me, showing up after me. Oh, well. And I sat down, Lord, on her front step. And she said, come in now, Jimmy. Buzz me just now left. Just now left. And I said, oh, yeah. She said, sure enough, dear.
90.3 WHPC, WHPC HD is the station. The show is American at Radio, and we're here every Friday from 5 to 6 p.m. doing what we're doing now, the How Music Changed series. Of course, here we're focused very closely on Jimi Hendrix. And the three songs that I just played, I just want to reiterate again how I think that session is one of the best live sessions that he had done for radio, just with those three songs. I mean, everything about it is remarkable. The first track, Driving South, it sounds like it's Hendrix playing like he's driving at about 150 miles an hour. It's unbelievably great. And then into Catfish, hats off to Mitch Mitchell. The drumming on that is just absolutely astounding. He's basically supporting Jimi Hendrix in a way that it's hard to overcome. How great that is. And then the silliness of Hound Dog. They're just having a blast. The thing is, like I mentioned, those tracks were on a show that was called Top Gear. Now, the previous BBC shows that we did for Radio 1 were for a show called Saturday Club. And the reason it got so much better by Top Gear, when it was only like maybe half a year's time difference between the two, is I think there's two specific reasons. The first reason, I think, is that, you know, Jimmy was really beginning to grow into a rock and roll veteran in 9 months' time. When he went in on those early shows, he had the jitters. He was a little bit uncomfortable and nervous going into these theaters to record on the radio. At this point in time, he's not nervous anymore. He's just having fun. And it's coming out with like a lot more, like a stronger material and the way that he plays, the sense of confidence. But the second thing is that I think this is a big part of it too. The establishment, like the people who were at the radio station, slowly began to understand Jimi Hendrix a little bit more. Like, for example, when he was playing at Saturday Club, which was 6 months earlier, before the first album was released even, they were doing all of these different takes in this theater. And Jimmy was nervous in the first place. And they keep asking him to try it again and again. And the executives keep stopping and starting again. And they finally, like, they realize that it's getting late. And if they don't get their act together. They're not going to have time to go down to the pub afterwards. So they stop and they say, Jimmy, you know, look, I'm really sorry, but we seem to be getting quite a bit of distortion and feedback and we can't seem to correct it. And Jimmy's like, you know, are you kidding me? That's what I'm doing, is I'm making distortion and feedback. And they're like, oh. So that's the way that it was then. But by now at Top Gear, this is basically one of the first shows that had been produced by the pirate radio genius John Peel. John Peel just got hired to be the DJ at Top Gear. And this Hendrix series that we just played, those three songs, is one of his first sessions. So that's a, you know, a pretty big deal. Now, John Peel went on to do something like 2,500 shows over the course of his career, usually with very obscure acts. This one in particular, though, when it went on the air, it was the songs we just heard by Hendrix. It also had The Who, The Bee Gees, Scott McKenzie, and The Incredible String Band, which was obviously quite the layout. He would go back in late December. Now, this is probably just around the same time as his second album will be released, but we'll save the second album, like as I said, for next week. And now we'll play some, basically a different session of Top Gear, again, with John Peel, basically running the microphone and basically keeping everybody cool and keeping things set. And now you can hear just how much fun Jimi Hendrix is having. He's not worried at all. He makes a song up on the spot to open the show. He does like a Radio 1 theme. And then he goes into a Beatles cover, and then he goes into one of his own songs called Wait Until Tomorrow. We'll play the three of them back to back, just to give you a feel of just how loose Jimmy is at this point in time.
We got a radio jingle for you, okay? Okay, if it goes name Radio 1, you're the one for me. You're the only one for me. Just turn that dial, make your music worthwhile. Radio One, you stole my gas. But I love you just the same. We'll be right back.
Well, I'm standing here freezing inside your golden garden. Got my ladder leaned up against your wall. Tonight's the night. We plan to run away together. Come on, darling, me. There's no time to stall. And now you're telling me that I think I better wait till tomorrow. What you say?
You better wait till tomorrow.
I ain't gonna wait that long.
You better wait till tomorrow.
Gotta make sure it's right. So until tomorrow, good night. Hey, Dolly Mae, how can you hang me up this way? On the phone, you said you're gonna run off with me today. Now I'm standing here, lights have turned down, serenading fool. Hearing strange words stutter from the mixed up mind of you. And you keep telling me that think about a way to.
That's a track that, to my knowledge, he never played live on stage. I don't think I've ever heard a version of him doing that song, so it's kind of unique that he was doing it on the show Top Gear for Radio 1. Pretty cool. Now, this next track is, I think it's the very first time that Hendrix performs this song live. It's almost certainly the earliest recorded version, because if there was another one, I would have covered it already chronologically. So, and we haven't done that. So I guess this is where we catch up to Hendrix working on the song "Hear My Train a Comin'." So this is him with a small studio audience. Again, you can hear he's totally upbeat, because this is the same time where he basically throws out that Radio 1 fake, commercial thing and all that. And there's like, I'm reading the liner notes here, and what it says is this: the earliest recorded version, written when Hendrix was first in London, small but rowdy studio audience treated to a rather upbeat delivery, dealing with loneliness and isolation. In the Warner Brothers film documentary, there are visible tears as Jimmy plays an acoustic 12-string rendition. Not as long or as intense as later recordings, when it was said to be a focal point of his live show. But like I said, this is maybe the first version of Hendrix performing "Hear My Train A-Comin'," and we'll segue that into "Hoochie Coochie Man."
Yeah, I see we got a few friends laying around here in the studio.
Hi, Jimmy.
Yeah, okay, Mr. Nolan, I need to do a little number for you right here. You all together now? You all together?
Yes, we're all together. Yeah.
We'd like to throw a little bit of blues on you here. Yeah, okay, there we go. Get my heart together. Yeah,
Well, I wait around the train station, waiting for that train.
Thanks a lot, then. Yeah. Take it easy, then. I'll see y'all later. Merry Christmas, yeah. Same to you. I guess that's with me and my guitar now.
All right, I'm going to come back. I said I was going to play two in a row, but I figured I should at least do a quick intro, because the next track we're going to play is actually from a different show that was on Radio 1. Alexis Korner, one of the founders of like the whole blues movement in the London scene, had his own show called the Alexis Korner Rhythm and Blues Show. And he invited Jimmy to come on. And in turn, when Jimmy was performing, he invited Alexis Korner to come up and join him on stage during the performance. So you're going to be hearing bottleneck slide guitar on this track. It's not Jimmy. That's Alexis Korner accompanying Jimmy on the track. And if you listen close, if you're a Hendrix fan and you're used to, you know, like songs like eventually from his third album, Voodoo Child, you might realize that he started to pick up ideas for writing that song from ideas that he had for Muddy Waters, especially on this track, maybe even this version of Hoochie Coochie Man. We'll leave you with that, folks. I hope you had a great time, and we'll see you next Friday. Take care.
To my mother before I was born. She said, you got a boy child's coming. He's gonna be a son of a gun. He's gonna make you girls jump and shout. But then the world gonna know what it's all about. I'm here. I got a black cat bone. I got a mojo too, baby. I got a little John the Conqueror. We're gonna jump and mess with you. I'm gonna make you girl. Leave it by my hand. Out in the world gonna know. Everybody knows I'm here. I'm a hoochie coochie man.
seventh month of the seventh week. My seventh doctor said he was born for good luck. Like you see, I got 700 girlfriends and dollars.